Okie doke, so we're going to get started now with the class. Let me just say thank you to everybody for handing in your policy memos and for engaging in the group activities last week. Yesterday I got the report from the final group out of the 12. It had taken a while for some of the groups to get their reports in. So in the next day or two, I will send you all a report, and we'll post those reports on Courseworks, and we'll send you all a report on what the group said. I will say this, from looking at the 12 very quickly this morning, it seemed pretty clear to me that the number one choice of you guys in terms of the groups, I mean, the choice that actually showed up the most often was to create a purchasing pool for small businesses. That seems to be the most popular choice among the groups. We're going to try to get the... I know next week is spring break, and then on the 20th we have the second policy memo that is due. We're going to get to you either tonight or tomorrow at the latest that assignment, so that if you wanted to work on it before spring break, you could. And then, of course, you have all the spring break as well. It's due on March 20th. We're also going to try to get back to you by the end of this week, if we can, the policy memos that you handed in on the uninsured. I think at the latest, well, hopefully we'll have those back for you by, say, Friday of this week, have them available in the HPM office. But by the latest, we'd have them available by the beginning of next week. I also wanted just to bring one thing to your attention about the Medicare drug bill. I'm going to try to sort of bring to your attention interesting things that happen as the semester goes along. This past week, the state of Texas, Maine, and three other states, Kentucky, Maine, Missouri, and New Jersey, brought a lawsuit against the federal government challenging the requirement that the states give back via the clawback program large amounts of money to the federal government. And in that lawsuit, the Attorney General for the state of New Jersey, for example, says that the clawback provision undermines her state's ability to control its own destiny because it's a federal law that's requiring a state to help fund a federal program. So it's an interesting piece of litigation. I'm not sure. I have a feeling they're going to lose. The states are going to lose the litigation. But it's an interesting piece of litigation that shows, again, the extent of the intergovernmental tension that is ever present, but is still certainly present in the Medicare Part D drug program. The goal for today is to talk about managed care, the rise of managed care, how managed care has played out in the 1990s and 2000s, efforts by states and the federal government to enact Patient Protection Act to deal with the backlash against managed care, and the whole debate over whether or not consumers and individuals can and or should be able to sue their managed care plan, and what ERISA has to say about that. So that's really the plan for today. Before I begin on that, any quick questions that people have either about mechanics or anything we've covered so far? Okay. So let me start the discussion of managed care by noting that the hallmark of the employer-based private health insurance system that became entrenched here in the United States in the 1940s, the 1950s, and the 1960s, the hallmark of that system was to draw a sharp distinction, a line in the sand, a firewall between the provider of care and the payer of care. The provider provided the care, the payer paid the bill, essentially no questions asked. The provider submitted a separate bill for every service he or she or it performed. And the insurance company, the payer of care, paid a separate bill for every fee. So you had a fee-for-service system. You had a system in which there was a clear distinction between provider and payer, and you had a system in which the physician's autonomy ruled the roost. Nobody was going to question the medical judgments. No one was going to question the clinical decisions of the doctor, of the hospital, of the provider more generally. By the early 1970s, policy analysts were suggesting that that system in which consumers receive their health care paid for by health insurance companies provided by employers, that system, that employer-based fee-for-service system, had a number of fundamental flaws in it. What were some of the arguments? What were some of the flaws? What were some of the things that you think people started complaining about in the 1970s? Yeah. The comment, in case you couldn't hear, was too many tests for no reason. Anybody else? Yeah.
Like the idea that like the costs of it were kind of like the same throughout, like the fact that all of like the employees were paying similar prices, or like it wasn't, I don't know what to say, like mean tested or whatever.
Well, it was largely experience rated, which meant that there really was a variation in how much employers and employees and individuals paid depending on the health status of either the individual or the group. But cost, to the extent you point out, cost certainly was a big issue, and that actually is related to the comment by the woman prior to you about tests. I mean, one of the number one complaints that the business community had, that public payers had, that economists had when they looked at the system, was they said that this system in which you've got a third-party payer, in which you have a fee-for-service system, this system is inherently inflationary, and this system is one of the big reasons why healthcare costs are zooming up and up and up and up and up and up. Why do you think the system was considered to be so healthcare inflationary? Well, one of the reasons was pointed out by one of your colleagues just a couple of minutes ago. Providers clearly had an incentive to do more under the system rather than less. The more you did, the more tests you ordered, the more procedures you engaged in, the more activities you engaged in, the more services you provided, the more you were paid. You got a separate fee for every service you provided. The more you did, the more you got paid. And what about the consumer? Did the consumer care? Yeah. Well, it's interesting. The comment wasn't there concern over medical errors and malpractice? There was some concern over malpractice. Medical errors and the whole jargon of medical errors hadn't really entered the vernacular yet. We were not really at the point where we were talking about Institute of Medicine reports and other reports saying there's all these errors in the system. In fact, the doctor was still considered to be king, and the doctor was still considered to be almost always right. But doctors were concerned because there were medical malpractice lawsuits brought at times, and the whole issue of medical malpractice is one we're going to discuss later in the semester. But clearly, what about consumers? Yeah. The consumers weren't paying any of the bill. To the extent that your employer provided the full cost of health insurance for you, and your doctor said, I want you to get test A, B, C, and D, along with procedure E, F, G, and H, the consumer said, if that's what you think, fine with me. There was no fiscal check from the consumer because the consumer was not paying the bill. So you had a system which plausibly, arguably, allegedly was extremely inflationary because providers had an incentive to do more and consumers had an incentive to have providers do more. So that was one problem, rising costs. And in fact, if you look at healthcare costs in the 60s and 70s, and it's not an accident, this all started happening in the early 70s because you also had Medicare and Medicaid enacted in 1965. So by the time you get to the early 70s, you have got these new big federal programs, you have big private health insurance programs, and you have costs really zooming up. That's one problem. A second problem that analysts started suggesting was a result of this system, or at least was a product of this system, was what was known, what is known even today, as small area variation. Can anybody tell me what small area variation is? Yeah.
There are different levels of healthcare utilization by each within areas that are broken down into areas smaller than geographic regions. You may get to know that was nothing.
That's exactly where we're going, so sure, go right ahead. Go right ahead.
1974, John Weinberg.
Weinberg, but that's okay.
Weinberg. Sorry. Published the Dartmouth Atlas, Small Area Variation. He was basically trying to answer the question, why are healthcare costs rising? Why are healthcare costs rising in certain areas faster than others?
So that's exactly right. I mean, what Weinberg was a researcher at Dartmouth. He's up in New Hampshire there. It's kind of New England. Everything, you know, is sort of easy. It's laid back. And he says, all right, I'm going to look at Vermont. You know, I'll look at New Hampshire. I'm going to look at Vermont. And he says, I'm going to look at, you know, town A in Vermont. And then I'm going to look at town B in Vermont. And these towns are like 15, 20, 30 miles apart. They're really close by, but there's different hospital systems in the two towns. And Weinberg, looking in Vermont, said, geez, if I look at the rate of, you know, tonsillectomies, or if I look at the rate of heart surgery, if I look at the rate of anything, any medical procedure in town A versus town B, they seem to be dramatically different rates. This huge variation in the practice of medicine. Huge variation in the practice of medicine, even within relatively small communities. Weinberg said, well, geez, I could understand it if in, you know, small town Vermont they had practice pattern A and, you know, academic medical center in New York City, they have practice pattern B. That makes sense to me, says Weinberg. But why would it be the case that small area variation would exist? Weinberg also said, when I look at these two different communities, and when I look at what happens when person A shows up with the following symptoms in his hospital or her hospital, and person B shows up with the following symptoms in hospital B, I say, well, you know, hospital A, you know, you have, you know, the following set of symptoms in Burlington, Vermont, and you show up at the hospital, they're going to tell you to take two aspirin and go home, basically. You know, they're going to say, you're okay, just go home. You know, this is New England, rough it out. On the other hand, if you go to hospital B, they're going to immediately put you in the hospital, and they're going to cut your leg off. Well, I don't know. I mean, they're going to do some sort of bypass surgery. They're going to do something dramatic. And so Weinberg says, same symptoms show up in hospital A. They tell you to take two aspirin and go home. You go to hospital B. They admit you, and they do some procedure on you. So that's the second question Weinberg has. That's interesting, said Weinberg. You know, really big variation. So it's not only that there's variation in practice pattern. There's also big variation in cost. And then Weinberg says, well, geez, you know, the guy in hospital A, his health care cost $1,000. The guy in hospital B, his health care cost $10,000. Is it the case, said Weinberg, I'm kind of curious, is it the case the guy in hospital B ends up doing 10 times as well as the guy in hospital A? I mean, is the hospital that's spending 10 times as much money really producing 10 times better health outcomes? And so Weinberg says, let's look at some of the outcomes here. And lo and behold, it was not at all clear that person getting the more invasive procedures and more expensive care was getting the better care. Indeed, you might well have been better off going home with the two aspirin and going to bed for a couple of days than staying in the hospital for 3 days, picking up some infectious-based disease and getting truly sick, or at least, you know, not getting any better. So Weinberg says, there's a lot of small area variation, and it's not clear that it's producing better that one hospital is producing better outcomes than the other. So Weinberg says the reason, if we think about why there is so much small variation, what do you think the reason is? Why is there so much small variation, early 1970s Vermont? Well, it all gets back to what we were talking about before. Yeah, did you have a...
I would think it kind of depends on the doctor and his policy. I mean, if he wants to make a lot of money, he can say, well, you know, just to be on the safe side, you should have these five tests done, even if he doesn't think they're really necessary because he's not paying for them. And also there's abuse in the system. He could prescribe something that's not necessary but he'll make money on it.
Absolutely. I mean, the bottom line is it comes down to physician autonomy. It absolutely comes down to physician autonomy. If the doctor and community, if there's a practice pattern in community A which says that with the following symptoms, we in our community do X, then the doctors in that community follow that practice pattern. If 20 miles away there's a different kind of practice pattern, then the communities follow a different kind of practice pattern. And since there's nobody among the payers who's overseeing this, there's nobody among the payers who's checking the provider autonomy, since, again, provider under that system, under that insurance-based, employer-sponsored, fee-for-service system, since the doctor has total autonomy, the provider has total autonomy, small area, you know, the argument is that contributes to small area variation. Third problem, so one problem with the system that some analysts are saying is that, you know, costs are, you know, the system's too inflationary. Fee-for-service, third-party insurance leads to rising costs. Second problem is system leads to small area variation. Doctor has too much autonomy. Nobody knows quite what the best way to practice is. Doctors do whatever they want. Big differences. Third problem is there really was a lack of coordination of care. There really was a situation where, you know, if you went to Dr. A and you didn't like what you heard, you can go to Dr. B, Dr. C, Dr. D. If you were on a certain kind of medication, it could well be that nobody knew the five different medications you were on, and when you went to one kind of specialist, there really was not a lot of coordination of care. And the system which allowed you to go to any physician you wanted and have Blue Cross or your private insurer or Medicare or Medicaid basically pay at least part of the bill, the argument is the system contributed to that lack of coordination. So you have those three problems which analysts in the early 1970s begin to suggest are endemic and are caused at least in significant part by the existing employer-based third-party fee-for-service health insurance system. At that point, analysts start saying, well, are there some alternative models that we can think about which won't have these kind of incentives, which won't create these kind of problems? And all of a sudden, there's renewed attention that's paid to the prepaid group practices, which we talked about in this class weeks ago, to the Kaisers, to the group health. Group health was a staff model HMO. Kaiser was a group model HMO. Clearly, both of those plans did what? What they did was they broke down the distinction between provider and payer. Remember, under the traditional insurance, the provider provides the care, the payer pays the bills, and never the twain shall meet. Under the prepaid group plan, there's one organization, whether you call that organization Kaiser, whether you call it Group Health, whether you call it HIP, whoever you call it, there's one organization that is responsible for both paying for the care and delivering the care. It's breaking down that distinction. It's breaking down that firewall. And it's saying Kaiser is going to have a contract with Permanente, a group of doctors, and they're going to get paid a set fee by an employer, and they're responsible for everything. It's not simply the case that they're going to pay whatever the doctor wants. They're not going to pay the doctor a separate fee for every service. Now, they had different systems. Group Health basically had its doctors. They were a staff model. They had their doctors on salary. The doctors actually worked for Group Health. Got a salary. Kaiser, group model, Kaiser basically did what's known as capitate a group of doctors. They basically said to the doctors, we're going to pay you $100 to take care of Mary Jones. And you're going to get that $100 whether Mary Jones costs you $50 or $150. So right off the bat, say some of these analysts, say some of these economists, say some of these others, right off the bat, we can get at the cost problem. How do we get at the cost problem? Well, we flip the incentive. The doctors no longer have an incentive to do more and more and more and more. For example, at least in Kaiser, the more the doctor does, the less the doctor is going to make. I mean, if you're a physician and you're capitated for care, that means for each patient, you're going to get a set amount of money. If you're capitated for Mary Jones's care, then in theory, you have an incentive to do less, not more. If you're on salary, you work for group health, then it doesn't matter to you. You know, it's not like you're going to get more or less, depending on whether or not Mary Jones gets more or less care. So right off the bat, some analysts start saying, you know what, if part of the problem is this distinction between provider and payer is leading to rising costs, well, maybe if we flip the economic incentives, if we flip the way we pay doctors, if we change the way we pay doctors, well, these doctors are going to have an economic incentive to either be a little more cautious in terms of the amount of procedures and services they provide, or at least they're not going to have an incentive to do more and more and more and more. At the same time, say the analysts, we could also do something about small area variation if we look at Kaiser and if we look at group health. How do you do something about small area variation if you're Kaiser or group health or if you're any insurance company? If you're worried about small area variation, what do you have to do? Yeah.
Standard fee for service.
Well, it's not standard fee for service, but it's standard practice protocols and standard practice guidelines. You want to basically say to the doctors, you work for us. You're not an independent practitioner out there in the community. You work for us. You work for group health. And when you work for group health, whether you're at Clinic A, Clinic B, Clinic C, Clinic D, wherever you are within the group health system, here are our practice guidelines for dealing with folks with symptoms A, B, and C. You know, someone shows up at the clinic with the following symptoms, here's what you do. You give them 2 aspirin and you tell them to go home. Or you give them the following medication and you tell them to go home. Or you put them in the hospital immediately and you call for help. You know, whatever it is, here's the basic practice guidelines. Now, in order to come up with those practice guidelines, what do you need to do? How do you come up with those practice guidelines? The comment was ask doctors, but the trouble with asking doctors is they're going to say the way I do it and the way I want to do it is the way that's right. I don't want anyone telling me how to practice medicine. Well, there emerged really in the late 1970s a whole new field of research, a whole new field of health services researchers, a whole new field of folks who began to do cost-benefit analyses. They began to look at how much it would cost to provide a particular number of how much would it cost to treat patient A with the following symptoms with the following approach? How much would it cost to treat them with an alternative approach? What are the outcomes? What are the costs? What are the benefits? What's the most cost-effective? What's the most efficient? What's the most scientifically appropriate way to treat people with the following symptoms? Now, of course, once you begin to develop practice guidelines and practice protocols, again, what are you trying to do there? You're trying to reduce the autonomy of the physician. You're trying to tell the doc, you know, if person A shows up with the following symptoms, here's what you do. You don't have to have like a 20-minute conversation with them. Symptom A gets treatment B. And so you're trying to reduce physician autonomy to reduce small area variation. And then to the extent that you're worried that there's a lack of coordinated care in the system, you say, well, geez. And again, Kaiser and Group Health, they had begun doing a little bit along the line of practice guidelines. They had said, if you're a Kaiser doc or you're a Group Health doc, here's how we practice medicine. Similarly, those organizations assigned what was known as a primary care gatekeeper to each member of their health plan. And so analysts said, well, geez, if we look at these prepaid group plans, they've got an answer to the lack of coordinated care as well. What's the answer? Well, we'll give somebody a primary care gatekeeper. That gatekeeper will provide primary care services to, you know, Mary Jones. And in addition, that primary care gatekeeper will monitor and coordinate and provide access to the world of specialty care for Mary Jones. So if she needs to go to a hospital, if she needs to see a specialist, if she, whoever she needs to see, there'll be somebody coordinating the care. So in the early 1970s, you had a number of analysts who started to say, you know what, if we look at the prepaid group practice model, if we look at Kaiser, if we look at group health, if we look at HIP, that model has remedies, has answers, has solutions for these three big problems that are bedeviling the health insurance system. It has answers for rising costs. It has answers for small area variation. It has answers for lack of coordinated and lack of managed care. This is the best thing since sliced bread, said some analysts in the early 1970s. Now, Kaiser and group health in the early 1970s did not have very many enrollees. There were, in the early 1970s, probably about 3 to 4 million people in the United States enrolled in all of these prepaid group plans around the country. And almost all of them were on the West Coast, in California. I mean, there were some here in New York City and HIP, but almost all of them were on the West Coast, California and Washington State in particular. There was a culture, there was a niche, there was a small market for the prepaid group practice there. But those prepaid group practices more generally were very unpopular with doctors, with consumers, and with state regulators. They were unpopular with consumers. Why were they unpopular with consumers? What do you think? Yeah.
Because they're limited, first of all, like who they can go to. Where before they kind of, with the coordination of care, like having to go to their primary care provider and then kind of maybe referrals coming in and all that.
Absolutely. If you're in a Blue Cross plan and you live in California and it's 1970, you go to whatever doctor you want to go to, whatever office you want to go to, whenever you want to go, and Blue Cross pays whatever percentage of the bill they pay, and you pay the rest, and everybody lives happily ever after, and the doctor does whatever he or she wants, and that's how the system works for most people. On the other hand, if you happen to belong to Kaiser, is there someone dying out there? I don't know. What? Oh, yoga. So yoga? Oh, my gosh. At least that is there, okay. If you go to Kaiser, Kaiser owns its own clinics. Kaiser owns its own facilities. You have to go to their clinic to receive health care. You have to go to a group health clinic. You have to go to a HIP clinic. And so consumers don't like it because they feel like their freedom of choice is restricted. You got to go to their doctors. They don't have that many doctors. You're in their network. You're in their system. It's a pretty closed system. It's a pretty small system. And you don't have a lot of freedom of choice. Doctors hated it, generally. The culture of medicine generally hated it because, again, the doctor couldn't charge whatever he or she wanted. You know, in the fee-for-service medicine system, you're the doctor. You just do whatever you want. You charge whatever you want. You have all the autonomy you need. If you work for Kaiser or you work for Group Health, you're a salaried employee. If you work for Kaiser, you get capitation. And you're at financial risk. You got people telling you how to practice medicine. You got people giving you practice guidelines. If you want to refer someone for a test or if you want to send someone out for some specialty care, you got to get permission from the primary care gatekeeper. It's a much more restrictive system. And so physicians historically, from back in the 20s and 30s and 40s, all the way to the early 70s, had resisted fiercely that system, resisted it fiercely. And they would do things like say, you know what, we're not going to allow prepaid group plan doctors to have privileges in our hospital. They can't even practice in our hospital. They are a whole separate second-class tier of medicine. We want nothing to do with them. We want no part of them. And we don't want to tell our patients to join those kind of organizations because we don't think it would be good for the patient. So the consumers didn't like it, the doctors didn't like it, and because the consumers didn't like it and the doctors didn't like it, state regulators didn't like it. And in fact, state regulators in many states around the country banned prepaid group practices. They said it's illegal to have a prepaid group practice in our state. Not California, not New York, but lots and lots of other states actually banned such prepaid group practices. So you have this kind of interesting situation in which in the early 70s, some policy analyst types are saying, geez, here's a model that could solve some problems that our healthcare and health insurance system is coping with. But that model is fiercely resisted by consumers, by providers, by physicians, and by states. Enter into the mix Richard Nixon in the early 1970s. Nixon, as we know from a couple of weeks ago, was promoting national health insurance on and off, but wasn't sure that was going to go anywhere, but was also very concerned about rising health care costs. Nixon also was from what state? California. And that's where prepaid group plans and Kaiser had their biggest niche. And so Nixon and some of his advisors say, you know what, this prepaid group plan model isn't such a bad idea. We could use this model to control costs. We can use this model to get a handle on the healthcare system. But we have a problem. Everybody hates these prepaid group plans, unless they're already a member. And it's funny, it was, you know, the members of Kaiser and the members of Group Health Plan were remarkably happy with their health care. The doctors that worked for Kaiser and the doctors that worked for Group Health Plan in general were quite happy with where they were. But it was almost like they were the separate little cult, you know, this little group that sort of operated out there on its own. They were non-profit. All these plans, Group Health, HIP, Kaiser, all the others, they were non-profit organizations. They were mission-driven. They focused on primary and preventive care. You know, if the docs had to keep costs down, the way they had to keep costs down was to, you know, really focus on primary preventive care, to not have a lot of folks end up in the hospital. There were lots of studies that showed that the enrollees in Kaiser and places like that received just as good health care, if not better health care, than other folks, and it was certainly cheaper. And so Nixon says, I buy into the idea, but we have to do something about the politics of it. So enter into the picture a guy named Paul Elwood. And Paul Elwood says, big fan of this model also, and Paul Elwood says, you know what? The problem is these prepaid group plans, they have bad press. Nobody likes them. It's a PR problem as much as anything else. And so what Elwood says is what we ought to do is we ought to give a new name to these organizations. We ought to give them a new name. And instead of calling them prepaid group plans, I mean, who wants to belong to a prepaid group plan? It sounds kind of, who knows what it sounds like. Not something I want to join. But Elwood says what these organizations really do is focus on prevention. They don't focus on ensuring sickness. They focus on maintaining health. And so Paul Elwood says, why don't we call these organizations health maintenance organizations? And so for the first time, you've got someone saying, you know, let's encourage people to join an organization that's designed to maintain their health and to save costs and to focus on prevention. And so a new term enters the vernacular, and the term is HMOs, or health maintenance organizations. And in 1973, the United States Congress decides, at Nixon's pushing and with a lot of other politics involved, the United States Congress enacts what's known as the HMO Act of 1973. And the HMO Act of 1973 is designed to encourage the growth of HMOs, is designed to encourage the growth of these prepaid group plans, is designed to shift us away from this old-fashioned fee-for-service system that led to higher costs and small area variation and unmanaged care. Instead, we're going to have Kaisers everywhere. At least that was the goal, that was the thought, that was the idea. But it didn't work out as planned. Now, what the HMO Act said was, number one, we're going to give federal dollars, we're going to give federal money to organizations to create HMOs. So we're actually going to help them, we're going to give seed money to organizations to create HMOs. Number two, we're going to say that no state has the right to ban these. Any law, any state law which seems to ban prepaid group plans or HMOs is hereby preempted by federal law. And number three, we're going to tell large employers in a particular community that if there's an HMO in your community, you have to offer that as an option to your employees. So again, fairly significant effort to encourage a new kind of insurance system, a new kind of delivery system, to make this radical change, again, to break down the barrier. The old system and the entrenched system at that time had a clear distinction between provider and payer. The idea was now you were going to have a single organization that was responsible for both providing the care and paying the doctors. Break down that barrier. The federal government gave, just to give you a sense of money, during the 1970s, the federal government gave out $145 million in grants and $219 million in loans to 115 HMOs around the country to start up and to get going. So you went from a situation in which in 1970 you had 33 prepaid group plans around the country with about 3 million enrollees to 1980, where you had 236 HMOs with about 9 million members. So you had some growth in the 70s. You know, you went from 33 to 236, so you added about 200 of these HMOs across the country. And they went from about 3 million to about 9 million enrollees. But they seemed to reach a cap. There seemed to be a clear cap on the growth of this organizational style. Most consumers, even when given a choice, were not interested in joining HMOs, even if it was a little cheaper. Most doctors were dead set against being participants in HMO networks and HMO models. And of course, the Blue Crosses and the Aetnas and the Oxfords and the big insurance companies were dead set against this model as well. So while you had some growth through the 70s as a result of that federal legislation, growth was slower, much slower, than advocates hoped for. By the early 1980s, however, a new dynamic enters the picture. A new variable enters the picture. And the new variable that enters the picture there's two new variables that enter the picture in the early 1980s. One new variable is the business community. The business community, which was paying the brunt of the healthcare cost for most Americans, the business community, which was paying through cost shifting for the uninsured, the business community, which believed it was struggling financially and internationally because of the rising cost of the healthcare bill, the business community began pleading for some sort of new model. The business community became absolutely convinced that the employer-sponsored, fee-for-service, entrenched health insurance system was not working for the reasons we've talked about earlier. The business community was also convinced, though, that Kaiser was not the answer. that they would have a revolt among their employees, they would have a revolt among the local medical communities in their community if they tried to impose Kaiser on General Motors workers, or if they tried to impose group health on IBM workers. So the business community was pleading for help, but they said, you know what? The 73 HMO Act and this new form of prepaid, and this old-fashioned but newly invigorated form of prepaid group health plan, that's not the answer. And so they went, the business leaders went to their buddies in the insurance community, not the small little nonprofit Kaiser insurance community, but they went to their buddies at the big insurance, the big for-profit insurance plans in the United States. And they said, you got to help us out here. And over the golf course at the country club, I'm embellishing a little bit now, but what the heck. Over time, the business community and the insurance community began to have a conversation. And the for-profit insurance community says to the business community, all right, you know what? We have been fierce opponents of prepaid group health plans, and we still are fierce opponents of prepaid group health plans. However, we can give you the benefit of the prepaid group health plan without the terrible things that come along with it. We can give you the lower costs. We can give you the reduced small area variation. And we can give you the coordinated care without Kaiser. And how can we do this magical thing? How could we do this sleight of hand? How could we actually give you the benefit of Kaiser without Kaiser? Well, we're going to create and embellish a new kind of HMO. And in effect, we're going to call this new kind of HMO an independent practice association, or an IPA. And how does an IPA differ from Kaiser, from the old-fashioned staff or group model HMO? What's the difference? Well, in the old-fashioned group model, you had to go to the clinic. You had to go to the Kaiser clinic. You had to go to the group health clinic. And the doctors who worked for Kaiser Group Health were either salaried or capitated employees. Under the new IPA model, Prudential or Aetna or PacifiCare, whoever the big for-profit insurance company was, would enter into contracts with individual doctors. So they would create networks, but their networks would not be closed clinics. Their networks would be a book of doctors. So if there were 500 doctors in a local community, they would enter into contracts with a couple of hundred of them. And then they would say to IBM, you know what? Your employees can go to any one of these couple of hundred docs. They don't have to go to some clinic somewhere. They don't have to go to a Kaiser clinic. They can go to any one of these couple of hundred docs. This will be a looser form of managed care. Your employees won't mind it as much. There'll be more choice. They won't have to go to a clinic. They can go to an office-based setting. They can go to the same doctor they've always gone to. So the consumers won't be as upset by it, said the insurance companies. And the doctors won't be as upset by it because, you know what? We're going to pay those docs fee for service. We're not going to capitate them, generally speaking. Some capitated, but most said, you know, we don't have to worry about capitation. We'll pay them fee for service. So the docs will be happy. But we are going to create some practice protocols, some practice guidelines for our docs. We are going to assign a primary care gatekeeper to our enrollees. So we are going to capture some of the kinds of savings and some of the kind of approaches that Kaiser and Group Health had. We're going to have the best of both worlds, said these new IPA folks. We're going to have choice, plus cost saving. We're going to have fee for service plus reduced autonomy. We're going to have, you know, the latest and greatest advances in technology plus gatekeepers. We're going to balance these two models. Again, two very different models. Model A, which was the entrenched model, was go to any doctor you want, get total fee-for-service, little coordination, lots of small area variation. Pretty much everybody does what they want, and the doctor is king. Model B is you got to show up at the Kaiser Clinic. The doc there is on capitation or is on salary. There's practice guidelines. You know, very little freedom of choice. The IPA said we're going to strike a balance right in the middle. And we'll have enough choice to make everybody happy, but we'll have enough managed care to achieve the goals of managed care. And the business community says, geez, that sounds great. That sounds great. We're in. You know, throw my chips on the table. We're in. We like that idea. We like the idea of happy, you know, we're desperate. And if you're telling us that you're going to keep our employees relatively happy, but at the same time, you're going to have some you're going to manage costs and manage care, that seems like the best thing since sliced bread. And we like that idea. So in the 1980s, the business community buys into managed care, but what they buy into is a different kind of managed care, a different kind of HMO than the original model. They don't buy into Kaiser, they buy into this new model, the IPA model. And then later there's even Luciforms, point of service plans, which says, all right, if there's 500 docs in your community, we're going to have a network of 250 of them, but if you want to go to the other 250, you can, so long as you pay, you know, part of the cost of that, you pay a little deductible. We're going to have PPOs, I mean, all the new acronyms that you've heard about or read about. We're going to have looser and looser forms of managed care. We're going to give you the benefits of managed care without the burdens of managed care. And again, that seemed like magic to the business community. It seemed, and the business community, they just sign up one after another, after another, after another, because it seems like magic. And so managed care in the mid-late 80s, HMO growth in the mid-late 80s, just begins to skyrocket. It begins to skyrocket. And for the first few years, costs indeed seem to be under control. The rate of increase in health insurance costs really begins to moderate. By the mid-90s, premiums are rising only 2-3% a year. And the managed care plans are saying, see, we told you. We're giving you the best of both worlds. We're giving you managed care, but we're also controlling costs. The question, though, soon became, how were the managed care companies, how were these new kind of managed care plans going to control costs? How were they going to manage care? What would the tools be of managed care? Now, the traditional tools of managed care, the tools that Kaiser had always used, that Group Health had always used, the traditional tools of managed care were things like gatekeepers, were things like capitation, were things like utilization review and prior authorization. Those were the traditional tools of managed care. You'd have to get referrals from gatekeepers. You're really going to restrict the kind of care. You're going to focus on prevention. You're going to have restrictive networks. People are going to have to show up at the clinic. So you have restrictive networks, you have gatekeepers, you have utilization review for hospital care, you have prior authorization for specialty care, you have capitation and salary. Those are your traditional tools of managed care. And indeed, the new kinds of managed care talked about using some of those tools. They talked about gatekeepers. They talked about prior authorization. They talked about utilization review. They talked about some of those kinds of traditional tools. But that's not how they were saving money. How were they saving money? How were they keeping costs down? What do you think? Was it through prior authorization or was it through something else in the early 90s? Yeah. Sort of. I mean, the comment was the creation of diagnosis-related groups, which is a way that payers pay hospitals, that Medicare had adopted in the early 80s and some insurance companies adopted. Where you're on target, well, let me have a couple other people comment, and then, yeah. So they had a relatively healthy population. Yeah. Yeah. All of those things are right. I mean, they're all part of the story. There was decreased utilization of certain kinds of services. There were new kinds of payment systems to hospitals. But probably the pivotal thing was they were managing reimbursement, and they were managing costs, and they were using leverage. Basically, what they were doing was they were saying, you know, they would get the large employers in a community to sign up with them. And all of a sudden, they had a lot of lives, so-called, you know, covered lives, to use the vernacular, a lot of people. And they would go to hospitals, and they would say, you know what? There are 5 hospitals in our community. We're only going to send our members to 2 of the 5. If you want to be one of those 2, you better give us a really low rate. You know, how much are you going to charge us for the delivery of, you know, of new births? Well, you know, the other hospital is charging $100. You know, you better charge us 80 or less if you want our business. So they were using their leverage because at this point, in the late 80s and early 90s, the healthcare delivery system was extraordinarily fragmented. Hospitals were in standalone situations. You didn't have large hospital networks. You didn't have lots of mergers and acquisitions between hospitals. Doctors were in solo practice. And they were going to doctors and they were saying, you know what? There are 500 doctors in our community. We're going to sign up 200 of them in our network. And we're going to send all of our members to those 200 docs. If you want to be in our network, if you want those folks coming to your office, you can't charge us a separate fee for every service. You can't just bill us whatever you want. You got to take our lowered rates. You got to take our reduced rates. So the managed care plans in the late 80s and early 90s are able to use their leverage to get dramatic reductions in reimbursement costs paid to providers. And that's probably the main way that they were able to keep costs low, or cost increases relatively low in the early 90s, added to the fact that inflation then was relatively low more generally, added to the fact that the hospital community was relatively unorganized, disorganized, decentralized, and fragmented. So they had a lot of leverage. So they were clearly managing costs. The problem was managing costs had its limits. Over time, after a while, the hospitals got smart and they said, geez, you know, you can only bleed us so much. We can only have our costs cut so much. You know, and maybe, you know, there are 5 hospitals in our community. And you're coming to us and saying you are going to only contract with 2 of us. So you're really pitting us against each other. Well, you know what? Maybe we're going to go to the other 4 hospitals and we're going to work out a deal, you know, where we all affiliate, we merge. And then we're going to go back to you. We're going to have a changed bargaining power. So the bargaining power begins to change. the leverage begins to change. Some of the one-time savings you get by squeezing, quote-unquote, waste out of the system begins to change. And the question becomes, all right, in addition to managing costs, how are these health plans going to do about managing care? Are they really going to impose sharp prior authorization rules? Are they really going to impose sharp utilization review? Are they really going to have tight referral gatekeeper systems? Are they really going to manage care? Are they going to focus on prevention? Are they going to impose practice guidelines on their docs? Are they going to reduce physician autonomy to the extent they can in clinical judgment? Are they going to manage care? And as they began to try to manage care, as they began to use some of those traditional tools of the old managed care plans, what happened? What happened was the backlash, a significant backlash began to arise among consumers and among providers. Remember, the big insurance companies had gone to IBM and said, you know what, your employees won't mind because we're going to give them 200 out of the 500 docs in the community. But lo and behold, the consumers did mind. They did mind having their freedom of choice restricted. They did mind having to go through a gatekeeper to get referrals to a specialist. They did mind the fact that they couldn't go to Hospital A, they had to go to Hospital B, because that's where the plan had a contract. They did mind the fact that they had to pay for emergency room services if they went to an out-of-contract, out-of-network plan. They did mind that for the first time, on occasion, there was a situation in which the doctor was saying, I want you to take drug A, or I want you to take drug B, or I think we should perform surgery A on you, and there was somebody else who was overruling the doctor and saying, we're not going to pay for that. They did mind that also. Yeah. The question was, did most employees have what we would call cafeteria-style plans, where they were given a choice of plans? And typically, large employers, Columbia University, for example, offers a cafeteria-style to its employees. So I have a choice of 4, 5, 6 plans, including HMOs, point-of-service plans. I don't think they offer an indemnity anymore, but all sorts of different kind of plans. Most small and mid-sized firms don't offer choice, cafeteria-style choice. Most small or mid-sized firms enter into just one contract with one insurance company, and if you're an employee, that's what you get. And so the large majority of folks who work for small and mid-sized firms who had insurance were forced into managed care. The larger firms that did offer cafeteria-style plans increasingly began limiting them to sort of managed care options. So you can have Oxford versus Aetna versus Prudential, but it was fewer and fewer were offering sort of a traditional Blue Cross indemnity model. And if they did, the cost of that traditional Blue Cross indemnity model was skyrocketing, way, way, way much higher than the cost of the other plan. So, and that was one of the things that consumers were objecting to, because they were feeling that they were being pushed either without choice or with huge financial penalties for choosing otherwise into plans that were reducing their freedom of choice, reducing their ability to get certain kind of care, etc. So this consumer backlash begins. And of course the doctors hated it, the new kind of managed care, because even though the insurance companies had said, you know what, we're not going to make the doctors, sign up with the Kaiser Clinic, or we're not going to make the doctor work for a salary, in effect, the doctors felt they had to get special authorization for everything they wanted to do. They had to call 800 numbers to get permission. They were getting reduced rates because the HMOs were paying lower rates. There was all sorts of new paperwork. And most of all, their autonomy was being questioned. There was someone looking over their shoulder. There was someone saying, we don't think your suggested, prescription drug is the right one. We want you to prescribe another one. We don't think surgery is warranted for this person. They have to leave the hospital after 3 days, even though you want them to stay in the hospital for 6 days. On and on, the doctors feel their autonomy is being threatened. And so by the mid-90s, the consumers are beginning a backlash. The providers are beginning a backlash. And sort of the media and American culture picks it up. News channel after news channel starts reporting on abuses in the system. I mean, I remember Chuck Scarborough on NBC having this whole big expose, you know, of all these, you know, HMO abuses going on and people being denied care that they were needed. I remember, you know, watching ER on TV and the docs talking about, you know, the evil managed care plans, telling them how to practice medicine. I remember going to movies. I mean, how many saw John Q, the movie John Q? I mean, what's that movie about? What do you say? It's all about Denzel. That's true. That's true. That's very true. That's why I went. What the hell, you know? But what that movie is about is, you know, Denzel Washington is this, you know, he's this nice, upstanding, you know, great guy. He's got a cute little boy. The boy's sliding into second base, and, you know, he gets, you know, goes unconscious. Turns out he's got some big heart problem. The kid has some big heart problem. Washington had, or his character had, insurance, but the insurance denied the kind of service and denied the kind of care that the kid needed, the surgery, the operation that the kid needed. So, of course, what Denzel do? He takes the hospital hostage, he takes the doctor hospitals, and then ultimately there's a happy ending, yeah.
In the case, I mean, although I did joke around about it being all about Denzel.
Oh, like, come on now.
like, in John Q, like, they kind of picked out, like, a middle class, like, a middle class family. Was the media also, like, targeting the fact that, like, it was, like, middle class America, too, that was really, really, like, were they focusing on, like, certain populations to show, like, this?
Well, yeah, I mean, to the extent the media is going to... I mean, to the extent that these issues become real problems, it's for middle class and perhaps upper middle class, but certainly middle and working class folks. You know, the truly wealthy, you know, if Aetna says they can't have the $100,000 operation, they're just going to write a check. You know, it's folks that, you know, have no other choice. I don't know if anybody lives in a small town. Sometimes in small towns, you'll see in the local newspaper, you know, let's raise money to pay for a bone marrow transplant for little Johnny because, you know, nobody else will pay the bill or the person's uninsured. You know, it's not wealthy folks that are in that situation. It's middle class, working class, and perhaps upper middle class, depending on how you define it. And I think politically, you know, state politicians began focusing in on that population as well. And there were other movies. What was that movie with, what's her name? I just watched. Everybody watched the Oscars last night. It's pretty boring, I thought, actually, to tell you the truth. But what? There was a Grisham book. Yeah, there was a Grisham book. There were other movies. I mean, there was a whole host. All of a sudden, of sort of, it became, you know, the hot thing to, you know, to challenge and to, you know, attack the managed care plans as being greedy, as having CEOs that were making millions of dollars while people were being denied care. Wall Street had really bought into the whole managed care movement, so Wall Street was sort of demanding that these companies, you know, keep coming up with profits. So there was the argument that Wall Street was pushing for profits at the expense of health care. Doctors were saying, you know, there's bureaucrats at the end of an 800 line that are telling us how to practice medicine. And so in response to all of those kinds of things, state legislatures begin enacting what are known as patient protection acts, which are laws designed to protect consumers from the presumed abuses of the managed care plans, which are laws designed to say if you show up at the emergency room, you know, and a prudent person would have thought it was an emergency, if it happens that hospital is not in your managed care plan network, they have to pay the bill anyway. Because if, you know, if you're suffering an emergency, you should be able to go without worrying about who's going to pay the bill. Patient Protection Act said things like there have to be internal and external review processes, both within the organization and outside of the organization, if they're going to deny you care that you think you're entitled to and need. You can have direct access to certain kind of specialties. doctors pushed often for what were known as any-willing provider laws, you know, in which the insurance company's ability to limit the size of their network was significantly constrained. So you have and states passed laws saying you can sue your managed care plan for wrongful denial of care. So you have a whole host, just about every state in the country in the mid-90s responding to the backlash against this new kind of managed care. Every state in the country begins enacting a Patient Protection Act of one sort or another. And the managed care plans, in response to this political pressure, become looser and looser and looser. Say, all right, we'll give you more direct access. We'll won't require written referrals. You know, we won't use these traditional tools. And so the managed care plans all of a sudden are on the horn of this big dilemma. And the dilemma is, the tighter they manage care, the more they restrict the autonomy of the doctor, the more they require patients to go through hoops before getting certain kinds of care, the more they deny coverage for experimental care and say we're only going to cover, you know, certified, you know, approved care, the more they manage the care using the traditional tools of managed care, the more money they could save. The more money they could save. But the unhappier people will be, consumers, politicians, doctors, and others. On the other hand, the more they back off from those traditional tools of managed care, the more they allow people to go to any doctor they want without a written referral, the more they allow people to show up at emergency rooms wherever they want, the more they authorize and pay for experimental surgery of any sort, the looser they become, the bigger the network they provide, the less they try to impose practice guidelines on their doctors. In other words, the looser they become, the less they're able to save money, because the more they become like a traditional fee-for-service indemnity plan. I mean, some of those managed care plans began to look very much like an old-fashioned fee-for-service indemnity plan after a while. And so they'd go back and forth. They'd go back and forth, but clearly the backlash continued. The backlash continued. Yeah? Well, premiums were rising at a slower rate through the mid-90s, except by toward the end of the 90s, as managed care plans had wrung out some of those one-time savings, as the hospitals began to consolidate and merge and sort of have their own leverage, as new technologies and new drugs began to drive inexorably through the system, as inflation began to grow more generally, for all of those, and as the plans became looser and looser and looser, all of a sudden, the 2% increases in 95 were 8, 9, 10% increases by the late 90s. So the ability of the managed care plans to save money by the late 90s was declining rapidly. So the one thing that the managed care plans had been able to sell to the employers, had been able to sell to the workers, was, all right, we're keeping your premium rates relatively low. But by the late 90s, you know, costs were rising again, for lots of reasons, many of which had nothing to do with the managed care plans, but costs were rising again. And so now costs are rising again, plus the managed care plans are as unpopular as ever. So at that point, you know, really the whole industry was sort of in the midst of a crisis. Now, I do want to talk about the State Patient Protection Acts. Why don't we take a short break, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about the Patient Protection Act, and then we'll talk about the right to sue your managed care plan.
Right after class, 8:30, Tech Commons. We'll have free food from wherever I'm home. Should be good. Coming here, what's going to be happening this semester from SCA and from all the other students. So we'll see you guys all there.
Thanks. Okie doke. All right, I now want to switch to sort of the fate of these state efforts, the legal fate of these state efforts to enact patient protection acts, these state efforts to actually limit the ability of managed care plans to engage in one kind of action or another. Make sure everything's on here. And now I have to switch back to the law that we discussed a couple of weeks ago, ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. Remember, we talked about ERISA when we were talking about the uninsured, and I made the point that ERISA was a barrier to states enacting employer mandates. I don't know how many of you remember that. And the reason for that was what ERISA says is that states are not allowed to enact a law or a regulation that relates to an employee benefit plan unless that law or regulation is part of the traditional regulation of insurance. Now, ever since the 1960s, states have been imposing what are known as benefit mandates on insurance companies. This predates managed care. This predates HMOs. These are just what were known as benefit mandates. A benefit mandate is basically a law which says if you want to sell insurance in New York State, you have to include mental health as part of that insurance policy, or you have to include substance abuse as part of that insurance policy, or you have to include podiatry, or you have to include chiropractic services or dental services. Basically, these are state laws which tell insurance companies you've got to include the following benefits in your insurance plan if you want to sell insurance in our state. There are over 1,000 of these benefit mandates that the 50 states have enacted over the last 25, 30 years. Every state has some. Hundreds, thousands of these benefit mandates. So, of course, the question soon came up, are these benefit mandates legal under ERISA? And so what's the first question you have to ask? Well, that's the second question, but although that's an important. The first question is, does the law relate to an employee benefit plan? And here the answer to that is clearly yes, which I'm sure is why you jump right to the second, because the key question, as you point out, is the law part of the traditional regulation of insurance? And here's where it gets a little confusing. What the courts have held is that if you have a traditional insurance policy that's sold by Aetna, and what I mean by a traditional insurance policy, and again, this is pre-managed care. You have a traditional insurance policy in which basically IBM pays premiums to Aetna on behalf of its employees, and in exchange for those premiums, Aetna pays the bills for IBM employees when they go and see the doctor or go to the hospital. So Aetna is at risk in that situation, right? I mean, Aetna is getting a premium, but they're at the risk of the cost of health care. That's a traditional insurance policy. And what the courts have held is these mandates, these benefit mandates, like cover podiatry, cover mental health, cover substance abuse, states can impose these on Aetna. It's part of what the state historically has done. They've imposed these kind of mandates on insurance companies. On the other hand, say IBM over here decides instead of paying Aetna to be at risk for the cost of health insurance, health care, IBM decides they want to self-insure. Columbia University self-insures. So IBM decides they want to self-insure. What that means is IBM itself is going to be at risk for the healthcare costs of its employees. So when somebody from IBM gets sick and goes to the doctor or goes to the hospital for heart surgery, the cost of the care is actually going to come out of an IBM fund, not an Aetna fund. Now, IBM, if it self-insures, may still hire Aetna to process all the paperwork, and they might even also hire Aetna to conduct utilization review, to conduct prior authorization, to do all of these kind of managed care type things. What happened? The mic just went out?
Is it on? Great.
Is it on now? Can you hear me now? No. Just, no. How about that? How about that?
No.
Okay. I'd make a joke, but it's not so funny. I think the battery died.
What side does it take?
I have no idea. I'll give it to you. You can get it working.
That'd be great.
All right, well, I'm going to have to just try to talk so you can hear me at this point then. Wrong size?
Anybody have any of these?
All right, so we're all... Well, let's see. Is this working? Wait. This is working? But she's right. I have to stand in place. So. I don't like this. All right. I'll stand here as much as I can. We'll see how it goes. I guess it's better than screaming. What was I saying? Oh, IBM over there. So IBM has self-insured. This is terrible. IBM is self-insured. So IBM is now hiring Aetna just to process the paper. And Aetna is not at risk. IBM is at risk. Now what the courts have held is that in this kind of situation, the benefit mandates that the state of New York or the state of Texas have imposed, those benefit mandates do not apply to IBM. So if a company chooses to self-insure and the state has enacted a mandate to cover a certain kind of service, that mandate does not apply to the self-insured plan. Similarly, if the state imposes a tax on insurance companies in that state, which lots of states do, that tax does not apply to IBM. IBM is not an insurance company. It simply is a self-insured business. Similarly, if the state imposes capitalization and reserve requirements on insurance companies, those requirements do not apply to IBM when it self-insures. As a result, companies can pretty much do whatever they want when they self-insure. At least they could do anything they want and be free of state regulation. Doesn't mean they're free of federal regulation, but there is very little federal regulation of the insurance industry. It means the state regulations don't apply to the self-insured. There are now about between 120 and 125 million Americans who are insured in group health plans through their employer. So say there's 120 to 125 million Americans in employer-sponsored group health plans. Those are all known as ERISA plans because they're employer-sponsored group health plans. About, and again, the numbers are a little hazy on this, but somewhere between 56 million and 60 million of those employees work for companies that self-insure. Most large businesses in the United States self-insure. Again, the reasons to self-insure are kind of clear. You're free from state regulation. You're free from state taxation. You can pay claims on a, you know, pay-as-you-go basis as opposed to paying premiums in advance. And you still can hire Aetna to process all the paperwork. So your employee, you know, Jane Doe, who works for IBM, as far as they're concerned, they have Aetna. They have a card that says Aetna. They don't know that their company is self-insured or not self-insured. They just know that they have to deal with Aetna for the sort of paperwork processing. But basically, Aetna is not at risk for IBM's healthcare costs. Aetna is simply a third-party administrator for IBM's self-insured plan. Question.
Is the employer obligated legally to tell their employees in some fashion that they are self-insured?
Well, they're certainly obligated to tell them if the employee asks. Whether or not they're obligated to actually affirmatively say it in the first instance, I don't know. I don't know. I don't think so, because I'm trying to remember whether or not I know Columbia's self-insured, for example. I don't think I've ever gotten anything from Columbia saying we're self-insured. I've simply gotten things saying sign up for Oxford or sign up for this or sign up for that. So I don't think you have to, but certainly if you ask, you have to be told. It could be. That's up to the company. That's up to the company. It doesn't have to, but it could be. You know, the company could just decide to do it that way. Okay, so then, now you've got the situation where the self-insured are exempt from most of these mandates. And these kind of issues went up. You know, there was a Supreme Court case, for example, involving a guy who worked for a record company in Houston, and he contracted HIV and then AIDS. And his healthcare costs began zooming upward. And so his employer, at the end of the year, went to renew their health insurance, and the health insurance company said, sorry, we're going to have to significantly increase your premiums because you have this very sick employee. And so the record company said, well, we're going to self-insure instead, and we're going to impose on our self-insured benefit package, we're going to impose a $5,000 lifetime cap on any HIV-AIDS-related claims. So in effect, HIV-AIDS-related claims were not covered by that health plan, even though they clearly were medically necessary to the life of the employee. The United States Supreme Court basically held that self-insured plan had the right to do that, although subsequently, they had the right to do that under insurance law. That was subsequently held to be a violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act, but that's really so if you're self-insured, you can't discriminate against somebody because of their disability, or you can't say we're just going to cover blacks and not whites, or whites and not blacks, or whatever. You can't discriminate based on illegal conditions like race or religion or ethnicity or disability. But if you don't discriminate based on those, you can have whatever benefit package you want, you can cover whatever you want, and state benefit mandates don't apply to you. So in the late 1990s and in the mid-1990s, as every state in the country began enacting patient protection acts, the question became, how do these patient protection acts fare under ERISA? How do they fare under ERISA? And those patient protection acts generally do not apply to self-insured plans. So, for example, many states around the country through their Patient Protection Acts, require what are known as external review policies. They basically set up a system so that if you believe you've been wrongfully denied care by your insurance company, and you've asked the insurance company to reconsider, and they've reconsidered and they've said no again, then you have the right to go for an external review of that decision. You have the right to go through some state system in which the state will hire an external reviewer. Well, if you belong to a self-insured plan, you don't have the right to that external review protection. Now again, most people don't know whether they work for a self-insured plan or not. So what happens is Jane Doe calls up the state insurance department and says, I believe my insurance company has wrongfully denied me care. The first question that the state insurance department asks the employee, asks the insured, is who do you work for? And if you happen to work for a big self-insured company, they say to you, sorry, we can't help you. They say, sorry, we can't help you, but you probably have some employee benefits manager who works for your big company. Why don't you go talk to them and see if they can, you know, help you out? On the other hand, if you work for Joe's Pizzeria, small company, state regulator knows they're not self-insured, then the state insurance worker will say, all right, you know, you can go through our external review process. We'll see how it plays out. On the other hand, if the state insurance department person doesn't have a clue whether you're covered or not by a self-insured plan, they basically have to say to you, sorry, we'll get back to you to tell you whether or not we can help you. So about 56 out of the 125 million Americans with employer-sponsored group health insurance work for companies that self-insure. Any questions on that so far? Yeah. Well, two things. One, I would guess that most large academic medical centers do self-insure. On the other hand, by self-insuring, they typically don't limit you. They don't require you to come to that medical center for care. You know, and in fact, you can have access to the network of whatever, you know, you could be a self-insured plan that has access to the Oxford doctors or the Aetna doctors or the Prudential doctors. The self-insurance piece doesn't necessarily, it can limit where you get your care from, but it doesn't necessarily limit where you get your care from. It simply changes who pays the bill and who's at risk. But the odds are, I mean, again, I don't know the answer empirically, but I would say the odds are that most large academic medical centers do self-insure. Okay. Yeah. They have total control over that themselves. They could pretty much do whatever they want. I mean, basically, there is no requirement that any employer, we don't have an employer mandate in the United States. There's no requirement that an employer provide any form of health insurance to their employee. If the employer decides they're going to self-insure for just a limited, small, HSA, high deductible, catastrophic policy that covers relatively little, that's, you know, but explicitly excludes mental health, explicitly excludes substance abuse, excludes dental, excludes lots of things that are in theory mandated by state law. Well, the self-insured company can do that. So as a result of ERISA, more and more and more and more companies in the last 10, 15, 20 years have self-insured because they have a huge interest in self-insuring so long as the federal government doesn't tell them what to do. See, ERISA doesn't prevent the federal government from telling anybody, you know, any company, what to include or what not to include in their insurance policy. ERISA only prevents the states from doing that if you self-insure. So let me give you an example of something that happened in the early 1990s and then the mid-1990s. many states around the country began passing laws as part of their Patient Protection Act, which said that insurance companies had to pay for at least 48 hours of hospital care for a woman following the delivery of a child. The insurance company couldn't simply, you know, have what was known, you know, pay only for 24 hours, one night stay, have what's known as a drive-through delivery. You have to in and out, you know, zip in, zip out. You know, we're not going to pay for more. They couldn't do that. The states began to say you have to pay for at least 2 days of care and more in certain situations. There's a C-section, for example. Those 48-hour bans on drive-through deliveries only apply to companies that do not self-insure. They do not apply to companies that self-insure. In the mid-1990s, as a result of political sort of disgruntlement and complaints and upset that ERISA was allowing state, you know, well, let me put it differently. As a result of concern that ERISA was not protecting large numbers of women and that the states couldn't protect them, the federal government in 1996 passed a law which said you cannot have drive-through deliveries. You have to pay for at least 48 hours of hospital care following the birth of a child, whether you're in a self-insured plan or not. So the federal government can regulate the self-insured. The states cannot, however. So by the late 1990s, as a result of the perceived and the real limitations on the state's ability to regulate the self-insured, and it was a result of the fact that more and more and more companies were self-insuring to evade and escape state regulation, there grew politically increased pressure on the federal government and on Congress and on the president to enact a national or a federal Patient Protection Act. And so in the late 1990s, both Democrats and Republicans at the national level began pushing for a Patient Protection Act, a national Patient Protection Act, a federal Patient Protection Act that would not be limited by ERISA. In the 2000 presidential campaign, both Al Gore and George Bush proposed federal Patient Protection Acts. The main difference, is there a question? Yeah. Okay, the question is, that's an excellent question. The question was, why didn't Congress simply lift the restrictions on ERISA? Anybody want to hazard a guess as to why ERISA is so hard to amend? Who benefits from ERISA? Big business benefits from ERISA, and large unions, which also operate self-insured health plans, benefit from ERISA. So ERISA basically says to the big business community and the big labor community, you can have a self-insured plan that's essentially free from state regulation. And the business community and the labor community love it. And any effort to amend ERISA runs into huge opposition from the business community, from IBM, from General Motors, from Columbia University, I suppose. I mean, it reduces your ability. What ERISA does is it gives the big business the ability to develop whatever benefit package they want, to develop whatever health insurance package they want, without being constrained by state law and state mandates. So that's why it's so hard, and that's why Congress has not simply amended ERISA. The 2000 presidential campaign, both Gore and Bush proposed Patient Protection Acts at a national level. The main difference between them, and there wasn't actually that, I mean, there was a remarkable amount of convergence among both Bush and Gore, Democratic and Republican Patient Protection Acts that were being proposed in the late 90s. Both would include some basic protections of the sort that we've just described. Access to emergency room, access to specialists, restrictions on managed care plans to have limited networks, and the like. Of course, the managed care community was dead set against the Federal Patient Protection Act, as was the business community. But there was some growing, given the managed care backlash and given the limits on the states and the state ability to regulate self-insured managed care plans, there was growing political momentum during the 2000 presidential campaign on both sides of the agenda, on both sides of the aisle, for some sort of Patient Protection Act at a national level. The main obstacle, the main barrier to a national Patient Protection Act was a battle over the right to, you know, the shape of the right to sue your managed care plan. The main obstacle to a Patient Protection Act was whether or not and how you should have the right to sue your managed care plan. And I want to switch to that issue right now. And I want to warn you when I switch to that issue right now that when I talk about ERISA in the right to sue context, the self-insured versus non-self-insured issue makes no difference. So you have to bifurcate, you know, the lecture here. You have to bifurcate the discussion of ERISA here. When we're talking about benefit mandates, such as you have to cover mental health, or you have to pay for 48 hours of care, or you have to have, you know, podiatry coverage, in those cases, it matters whether you're self-insured or not self-insured. In what I'm about to talk about now, the right to sue, that issue doesn't matter. And so just a little tip on the memo that you're about to write that we're going to send out a notice to you about later tonight or tomorrow, and we're going to ask you to talk about the right to sue. Don't start talking about self-insurance as being key, because that's wrong. And it's just, I don't want, you know, as few of you make that mistake. So, I mean, in past years, lots and lots of people have made that mistake, and my guess is some of you will still make that mistake. And I want to try to warn you against that. Is there a, yeah?
Is this part
going
to be recorded, or is it
going to be recorded? Hopefully it's being recorded. Hopefully it's being recorded. I mean, I am recording right now. Yeah, so it should be recorded, assuming everything works. Okay. Now let me again, as I discuss the right to sue, let me again harken back to the old days when there was a clear distinction between provider and payer. In the old days when there was a clear distinction between provider and payer, the doctor performed whatever service he or she wanted to perform. The payer paid the bill. And if something went wrong, if there was a problem, if there was negligence, if there was a medical error, if you were injured as a result of the malpractice of a doctor, you would sue the doctor for malpractice. And you would say that that doctor's practice of medicine did not rise to the standards of care in the community, and that it was, you know, negligent care, and as a result of the doctor's negligent care, you were hurt. You cut off your right leg, and it was supposed to cut off your left leg, or whatever happened, which is actually what happened. That's why they actually have to start now marking what leg they're going to cut off, so that they don't cut off the wrong leg. We'll get back to that when we talk about quality and medical errors. But if there was negligence, you'd sue the doctor. Or if you believed you were the victim of negligence, you would sue the doctor or the hospital or the provider. And you would bring those lawsuits in state court. And in state court, what you could win would depend on state law. But generally speaking, in most states, you could win damages for the emotional distress of having been injured the way you were injured, for the physical pain of having been injured the way you were injured, for the loss of economic well-being. Maybe you lost your job, or you lost a month of work, or you lost 6 months of work, or you couldn't keep the same kind of job. So your economic losses. If this was the 15th time the doctor had committed malpractice, you could try to get what were known as punitive damages, basically to punish the doctor for a pattern in practice of negligent behavior. You could have a whole host of options and compensation to compensate you for the negligence of the physician. Now, we are going to talk later in the semester about medical malpractice and what's now going on in the medical malpractice system, and is there a crisis in medical malpractice, and should the states change the way their medical malpractice systems work, and what are states doing and what states not doing, and is this really affecting the practice of medicine, and the doctors really have to pay so much higher in premiums right now. We're going to come back to all of that stuff later in the semester. But suffice it to say for right now, pre-managed care, when there was a clear distinction, bifurcation between provider and payer, the problem was, who do you sue for negligence? And the answer was, you sue the doctor in state court. Or hospital, or whoever you believe, you know, was acted negligently. Managed care comes along, and this clear distinction between provider and payer begins to break down. The clear distinction between provider and payer begins to break down. And in addition, remember I said half an hour ago, a lot of people start complaining and worrying and feeling as if they're being wrongfully denied care because there's some evil managed care company which is saying they can't get the care that they need. And so you have situations in which people have now two kinds of complaints, two different kinds of complaints. One kind of complaint is that they've been wrongfully denied care. The second kind of complaint is they got the care, but it was negligently provided. But in addition to suing the doctor, they also want to sue the managed care plan because they think the managed care plan should be responsible for the doctor's actions. So you have these two different kinds of lawsuits that come into the arena for the first time as a result of managed care. So let me first talk about wrongful denial cases, and then I'll talk about quality cases. There was a young woman named Mrs. Corcoran, who became pregnant. Her doctor said, you know what, you have a high-risk pregnancy, and I think you ought to spend the last month or two of your pregnancy in the hospital, where we can take care of you and watch you every day. The woman says, okay. She goes into the hospital, delivers her baby, baby's fine. A year or two later, she becomes pregnant again. Her doctor says, you know what? High-risk pregnancy. I think we ought to put you in the hospital again. But now there's a managed care plan that the woman belongs to. And the utilization review people in the managed care plan say, you know what? We don't think you should sit in the hospital for the last 2 months of your pregnancy. We agree you should stay in bed. We agree you should stay home. And we think what we want to do is send a nurse to see you, you know, once a day or once every couple of days or whatever it is, you know, to check in on you periodically and to take all the vitals, to check on everything. But we don't want to pay for, and we won't pay for, you know, 2 months of hospital care for you just to watch you prior to your delivery of this child. Doctor says okay. Woman says okay. She stays home. She has a miscarriage. and she loses the baby. She brings a lawsuit against the insurance company, against the managed care plan, claiming that she had been wrongfully denied care that she needed. She'd wrongfully been denied hospital care, that if she had been permitted, allowed to stay in the hospital would have seen whatever signs of distress indicated trouble was looming. They would have taken action. And instead of having a fetus that died, she would have had a baby that lived. And she wants to bring a lawsuit against the hospital in state court for emotional distress, for pain and suffering, and for all sorts of other damages, punitive damages and the like. Now here's where ERISA comes in. There is a provision in ERISA which says that if you belong to an employer-sponsored group health plan, if you belong to an employer-sponsored group health plan, and you have a dispute with your plan over the contract coverage of that plan, you have to bring that dispute, you have to bring that case exclusively in federal court. You cannot go to state court with that case. You have to bring the case in federal court, and when you bring the case in federal court, if you win, your remedy, your compensation, is limited to the cost of the care you were denied. You cannot get damages for pain and suffering. You cannot get damages for emotional distress. The only damages you get are for the cost of the care you were denied. It was a contract dispute that you had with your managed care plan. They said the contract covered X. You felt it covered Y. If you really wanted to stay in the hospital for those 2 months, you could have and you should have paid for the hospital bill yourself. But you can't, and then sued the plan for the cost of that, your out-of-pocket costs. But you can't simply stay at home, suffer the damages, and then sue for pain and suffering and the like. And so Mrs. Corcoran is required to bring her lawsuit in federal court, and when she wins, she is basically awarded the cost of the hospitalization care that she was denied. So if it's, I don't know, if it's $500 a day back then for that hospital and she was denied, you know, 30 days of hospitalization care or 45 days of hospitalization care, she would get 500 times 45 days, and that would be her compensation. As opposed to, had she been able to bring that case to state court, and had she won, I mean, had a jury concluded that the insurance company had really acted negligently in denying her that hospitalization care, she probably would have won hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not more, for pain and suffering, emotional distress, and the like. So that's the Corcoran case. That rule basically applies only to people in ERISA-based group health plans. And here's where, as I said, it has nothing to do if you're self-insured or not self-insured. This has to do with the 125 million Americans who get their health insurance from employer-sponsored group health plans. If you're one of those 125 million and you're in Mrs. Corcoran's boat, you got to bring the case, says the court, in federal court, and your damages are the cost of the care denied. Now let me tell you about another case involving a guy named Mr. Goodrich. The Corcoran case was sometime in the early or mid-80s. It's in my notes, but I'm not allowed to leave here. Sorry. I'm chained to this this microphone here. Yeah.
Why
well, what she was suing, she could sue the hospital, but what could she sue the hospital for? The hospital basically had not done anything wrong to her. No. I said she could sue the managed care plan for wrongful denial, but she had to bring that case in federal court. She couldn't sue the hospital for anything. If she, on the other hand, if she had been able to bring the case in state court, I said, she could have sought emotional distress, pain and suffering, compensation, etc. But she couldn't do that, Mrs. Coughlin. Yeah. That's a good question. Let's come back to that when we discuss the quality cases in a minute. The question was, why couldn't she sue for poor quality of care as opposed to wrongful denial of care? And this time I didn't use the excuse that I can't walk the 10 feet, and that's why I'm not answering you. I used a different excuse, which was, we're going to come back to that in 10 minutes. But it's a good question, but when we talk about the quality cases, we'll talk about her ability to bring that case for poor quality of care. Because there are limitations on that as well, which we'll talk about. So now I want to talk about Mr. Goodrich. Mr. Goodrich was a county prosecutor in, I think, San Bernardino County in California. One of the counties in California. I think it was San Bernardino, San Mateo, one of those counties. But he worked for government. He developed stomach cancer. His doctor wanted to provide him with some sort of bone marrow transplant to deal with the stomach cancer. He had Aetna as his insurance company. Aetna said no. Aetna said the service is, this kind of treatment for this kind of condition is experimental. It's not proven. It's not going to help. It's going to cost a lot of money. And we're not going to pay for it. His doctors challenged Aetna's decision within Aetna. Round and round and round it went. And then he died. His spouse, decided she wanted to sue Aetna for wrongful denial of care. Now, if Mr. Goodrich, instead of working for the county of San Bernardino, if Mr. Goodrich had worked for Columbia University or IBM or General Motors or Joe's Pizzeria and had gotten his health insurance through his employer, he would have been required to bring that lawsuit in federal court under ERISA, and his compensation would have been the cost of the surgery he was denied. Say it was a $200,000 operation, he would have gotten $200,000. However, because he did not work for an ERISA-based plan, because he worked for government, because he wasn't one of those 120 million who were bound by ERISA to bring that kind of case in federal court, his estate, his family, his wife, his spouse, his kids were able to bring that case in state court against Aetna. And in state court, they went before a jury, and the jury awarded $4 million in actual damages, the pain and suffering, lost wages and the like. And the jury also awarded $116 million in punitive damages against Aetna. So the entire verdict against Aetna was $120 million. So here you had a situation in which, because he happened to work for government, his family got $120 million in a jury verdict. Had he worked for General Motors, his family probably would have gotten about $200,000 from a judge. If you work for government, if you buy health insurance through the individual market, if you're a public beneficiary of a program like Medicaid or Medicare, you can bring these cases directly in state court. However, if you work for an employer-sponsored group plan, you have to bring them in federal court. That decision was front page news in the newspapers, in the New York Times, on the national news, and the like. That decision was criticized immediately by the chief executive officer of Aetna, who claimed that the decision, and I should have brought it with me, but I didn't, but that decision was the product of a weeping widow, you know, who looked sympathetic on the stand, and a biased jury. As a result of those comments, the CEO of Aetna was forced to resign. So, I mean, this had major impact, major implications nationally. But the decision, and ultimately, Aetna and the Goodrich family settled the amount. I mean, Goodrich had appealed the verdict. I mean, Aetna, Goodrich didn't appeal the verdict. Aetna appealed the verdict as being excessive, even in state court. And while the appeal was pending, the two sides worked out a settlement. It's not public how much he actually got, or the family actually got. But I do know, because I know from someone who works for Aetna, he got a lot, the family got an extraordinarily large settlement out of it, because Aetna basically wanted this just to go away. So they got a huge, huge amount of negative publicity around this. Plus, it was a huge financial hit on their California subsidiary. So, but what that case did was it also generated a lot of publicity to the disparity in how people would be treated and are treated based on where they work. If they work for an employer-sponsored group health plan and they're claiming wrongful denial, they're treated one way. If they work for government or if they have individual health insurance, they're treated a different way. Advocates on both sides pointed to the Goodrich case as ammunition for their point of view. If you represent an insurance company, what is it that you're going to say about this kind of decision? Yeah, you're going to say, you know what? It's actually darn lucky that there's only a relatively few number of people that have the ability to bring these kind of lawsuits. Because if everybody could bring these kind of lawsuits, and if everybody was getting these $100 million verdicts against insurance companies, then the cost of insurance would skyrocket, would escalate, you'd have more uninsured, and the healthcare crisis would get worse and worse. On the other hand, yeah, what would someone on the other, what's the sort of opposing point of view? Anybody want to take the opposing point of view? The opposing point of view is, as a matter of equity, as a matter of justice, and as a matter of accountability, you shouldn't be distinguishing between people based on their employment status. If somebody is treated negligently, if somebody is indeed wrongfully denied care, and if a jury does indeed decide that, you know, an insurance company is guilty of negligently denying care, that people should receive compensation for their loss, and that it's up to the American jury system to determine what that compensation would be, and that therefore everybody should be able to bring these kind of cases in state court. Everybody should be treated equally. It's going to make the insurance industry more accountable. It's going to make the insurance industry less likely to wrongfully deny care. I mean, I always sort of point out in these classes, because it was just sort of an amazing experience for me, during this era when this was all going back and forth, there was a very large insurance company, probably one of the largest insurance companies in America, that would sponsor an annual conference on sort of what was happening in ERISA. And they had me come a couple of times not to talk about anything having to do with ERISA. You know, they would have this conference once a year, but sort of at lunchtime I would just sort of chat with them about whether or not we were going to have national health insurance. You know, some just sort of supposedly fun, different sort of lunchtime speech that had nothing to do with ERISA. But I would kind of hang out and listen, you know, at the rest of the, for the rest of the day. Well, basically, the entire thrust of the conference, the entire thrust of the effort, was to create legal strategies to maintain the ERISA status quo. You know, to keep the 125 million who now were prohibited by ERISA from bringing cases in state court, to keep that in place. And there were similar conferences going on among plaintiff trial attorneys as to how do we get these folks, you know, these 125 million folks into state court. You know, how do we get Congress to change this law? So a huge political battle starts to brew. At this point, late 1990s, you've got the 2000 presidential campaign between Gore and Bush. And where they disagree, they agree that there should be a National Patient Protection Act. They also agree that those 125 million Americans ought to have a right to sue for more than just the cost of the service they were denied. Where they disagree, though, is Bush and the Republicans basically want to impose a cap on those lawsuits of anywhere from $1 to $2 million, basically saying you can bring those kind of lawsuits, whether in state court or federal court, and get more than the cost of the service denied, but there will be a cap of $1 or $2 million on verdicts. And the Democrats were saying, we agree there should be a cap, but there should be more like a $5-10 million cap. So the Democrats wanted a much more generous cap. The Republicans wanted a much smaller cap. And that's where the battle was in the late 90s between Democrats and Republicans. Both sides agreed that the status quo in which Mr. Goodrich's family got $120 million and Mrs. Corcoran got, you know, whatever 45 days of hospitalization care cost was wrong and should be changed. So that's the situation as it existed in the year 1999 and the year 2000. Now, I'm going to come back to the year 1999-2000 in a minute, but let me switch gears for a minute and talk about quality cases now. Kind of like I hear everybody's flip the page. It's kind of like being a cop. It must be great to be a cop, and like you're sitting on the side of a highway, and like you just see everybody hit the brake lights as they're coming across the city. You know, it's like, you know, I don't get that kind of power, but I get to flip the page. All right, we're done with quality cases. Now we're going back to the wrongful denial cases. You have to flip the page back. No, just kidding. I'm being a little power hungry here. All right, so quality cases. Now you're in a situation in which you're not denied the care. You're actually given, you know, you get the surgery. You get the care. But there's some negligence. It's poor quality. And sure, you could sue the doctor. Sure, you could sue the hospital. But you also want to sue the managed care plan. Maybe you also want to sue the managed care plan because you think the doctor has an insurance policy that's relatively limited and you want, you know, you want to be able to collect even more money and the managed care plan has big pockets. Maybe you want to sue the managed care plan because it's a staff model HMO and it was a Kaiser doc and you think that Kaiser is just as responsible for what went wrong as the doctor or the nurses. For whatever reason, you want to add in the managed care plan to your quality lawsuit. And in these kind of cases, ERISA is irrelevant. ERISA is irrelevant to poor quality cases. You can bring those cases in state court if, and here's the big if here, if the state allows you to bring those cases. Now, here, the biggest obstacle to suing a managed care plan for poor quality is that most states historically and traditionally had laws which prohibited what was known as the corporate practice of medicine. So an HMO or a managed care plan was prohibited by law from quote-unquote practicing medicine. And so if you as an entity could not practice medicine, how could you be sued for delivering poor quality or negligent medicine? So in many states, those HMOs were able to use the corporate practice of medicine requirement to evade litigation on poor quality allegations. Question.
Were those corporate
laws enacted for that reason to protect the... No. Those were older laws that had been enacted primarily as part of an effort to limit the rise of managed care, and to limit prepaid group practices. That's right. I just took my reading glasses off, my other glasses on, and I can actually see you all now. So, yeah.
I have a question about which states will allow you to bring the case. So, for example, in a situation like, say, Columbia Hospital, where they take people from
different states. If you want to bring a lawsuit in a particular state, you bring the lawsuit in the state where the negligence occurred, and you are not where you live, and you are governed by that state's law. Now, as George Bush pointed out during the 2000 presidential campaign, the first state in the nation to allow you to sue your managed care plan for poor quality care was the state of Texas. Did I talk about this in this class once earlier? I thought I did. Everything's blurring. All right, maybe I didn't. What Texas did was they had in the mid-90s, they enacted probably the most aggressive and expansive Patient Protection Act in the nation. Interestingly, and I make no political editorials on this, I'm just telling the facts. Interestingly, George Bush, as governor, vetoed the first version of this bill that passed the state legislature. There was a huge consumer outcry over that veto. The state legislature enacted the bill a second time, and at that point, Bush did not sign the bill, but he didn't veto it either. And under Texas law, if the governor does nothing, the bill becomes law. So in effect, Bush allowed the bill to become law, even though he didn't affirmatively sign it. Basically trying to make clear that this wasn't his idea. You know, this was really being imposed upon him by the legislature. Interestingly, a couple of years later during the presidential campaign, he proudly touted the bill as an example of, you know, leadership during his era in Texas. Regardless of how it happened and who did what, Texas indeed was the first state in the country and indeed has perhaps the most aggressive Patient Protection Act and the most aggressive right to sue in the country. And I can't really tell you exactly what the politics of that are, you know, and why it was that Texas emerged first in that crucible and why it was they actually enacted that law the way they did. I don't know the politics of it more than what I just told you, but I do know they were the first. So in Texas, and then in about a dozen other states which enacted similar laws, you were allowed to bring poor quality cases against both the doctor and the managed care plan. And whether you win or not often depends obviously on whether or not there was negligence, but even more importantly, it depends on whether or not there's a close relationship between the managed care plan and the physician. If it's a Kaiser group plan, you have a much better chance of winning than if it's a huge IPA in which the doctor performed the negligence in his or her office, far away from the home office of the IPA. But that becomes a factual matter. So by the late 1990s, you had a situation in which, maybe I actually will sort of yell a little bit, but just sort of write down these three different. You had wrongful denial cases. In which
you have one rule for ERISA plans and another rule for folks in non-ERISA plans. And these folks in the non-ERISA plans could sue in state court and get essentially unlimited damages, and these folks have to sue in federal court for very limited damages. And then you have poor quality cases, which you could bring in state court if the state allows.
In the year 2000, the United States Supreme Court issued a decision which seemed to throw that whole diagram into flux. The decision was in a case known called Pegram versus Herdrich. P-E-G-R-A-M versus Herdrich, H-E-R-D-R-I-C-H. Excuse me? Say it again. Pegram, P-E-G-R-A-M, versus Herdrich, H as in Harry, E-R-D-R-I-C-H. 2000, I think it was. And in this case, here's the story in this case. In this case, a woman goes to her doctor complaining of significant stomach pain. The doctor examines her. And the doctor says, you know what, I think you need an ultrasound. I want you to make an appointment to have the ultrasound done at the diagnostic imaging facility down the block. Woman says, okay. Woman calls up the facility and says, I need to make an appointment to have an ultrasound. Facility says, we're kind of booked up. The first appointment we can give you is in a week. The woman calls her doctor and says, first appointment they can offer me is in a week. What do you think? The doctor says, no problem. You know, just it's not an emergency. Have it done in a week. The next day, the woman's appendix bursts. And she suffers all sorts of complications. She brings a lawsuit against the doctor for malpractice in state court. And she wins. And she wins a judgment against the doctor. However, she also decides, after talking to her lawyers, and after looking at the relationship between the doctor and the doctor's HMO, that the reason, in her view, the reason that this doctor had been so insistent that she only get the ultrasound, even though an ultrasound isn't even what was called for, given her circumstances, but that she only get this ultrasound at this particular facility was because under the doctor's physician-owned HMO contract, if you had ultrasounds done at this facility, it basically was good from the doctor's point of view. If you sent someone to a out-of-network imaging facility, the doctor would actually suffer an economic loss. The doctor would be penalized financially for sending somebody out-of-network. And so the woman basically brings a lawsuit challenging the financial incentives and saying the reason the negligence took place was because of these financial incentives. Case goes to the United States Supreme Court. And the United States Supreme Court and Justice David Souter issue a decision in the case in 2000 in which the holding of the decision is, you know what, the woman loses, the HMO wins. Capitation is fine. You know, Congress knew perfectly well when they enacted the 1973 HMO Act, that you know, capitation and financial incentives could have unfortunate consequences in particular situations, that there's nothing illegal about these kind of financial incentives, that while we feel bad for this lady, we're not going to throw out capitation, which is essentially what the woman was asking. She was asking that the court, Supreme Court, hold that capitation as a form of payment was illegal. And the Supreme Court says we're not going to do that. You know, that would basically end the HMO industry, it would end managed care as we know it, and there's no basis for doing that. So at first blush, this seems like a big victory for the HMOs and for the managed care plans. However, in his decision, Souter also speculates and talks a little bit about this distinction that I have up on the blackboard there between wrongful denial cases and poor quality cases. And he says, you know what? It seems to me, echoing your classmate over here, it seems to me that this is a distinction, it's a spurious distinction. If you wrongfully deny care to somebody, says Souter, you're providing poor quality care to them. So to say that you can bring a poor quality case in state court, but you have to bring a wrongful denial case in federal court if you're in an ERISA plan seems a little nuts to me, says Souter. He doesn't use those words exactly, but that's basically what he says. So he writes that in the decision. Trouble is, that was just Souter speculating. It had nothing to do with the decision before him. It is what was known by lawyers and in the legal profession as dicta, D-I-C-T-A, which is Latin for, I don't know, irrelevant or something. I mean, I don't know if that's right, but what the hell. Is this being recorded? It had nothing to do with the decision before him. It was just him kind of speculating. And when judges do that, when the Supreme Court does that, that's what's known as dicta. Now, dicta, on the one hand, is not legally binding. So it's not as if Souter in that decision struck down this distinction between wrongful denial and poor quality cases. On the other hand, when somebody on the Supreme Court talks, people listen. You know, and the argument is nothing goes in by complete accident to a Supreme Court decision. You know, so that if Souter was suggesting that this is a distinction without a difference, there must be something to it. So the lower courts, the trial courts, and the courts of appeals then had to struggle to figure out what to do. Do they apply the distinction between wrongful denial cases and quality cases? Do they require those folks who work in ERISA plans to continue going to federal court and others going to state court? Or do they say that everybody who's wrongfully denied care or claiming that they're wrongfully denied care can go to state court and say they're also being given poor quality care and sort of get into state court via the poor quality care hook as opposed to the wrongful denial hook? Everybody with me so far? Okay. This bounces around the circuits and nobody knows what to make of it. Meanwhile, this happened, remember, in the year 2000. That was the same year that Bush and Gore and the Democrats and the Republicans are debating whether to have a National Federal Patient Protection Act. And remember, the key political barrier between them was whether to have a $2 million cap on such suits that the Republicans wanted, or a $5, $7, $10 million cap on such lawsuits that the Democrats wanted. It was $2 million versus $7 million in terms of a cap. But here's David Souter in the United States Supreme Court all of a sudden saying, you know what? Maybe there's no cap. Maybe everybody could bring these cases in state court under poor quality laws and win $120 million like the Goodrich family. And so now Teddy Kennedy and the liberal Democrats aren't sure what to do. Should they support a Patient Protection Act which imposes a $7 million or a $5 million cap even though they don't think they want a cap, but they think that's the only way to get an agreement through Congress, or should they assume slash hope that Souter is actually speaking for the court, and that a couple of years down the line, the court is going to issue another decision and make it clear that there's, you know, no limit on the ability to go to state court and it's just up to the states. In which case, Kennedy doesn't want a cap. So the Pegram decision throws the debate in Congress into turmoil. And the Democrats now decide, you know what, let's see what happens in the courts before we push ahead with the Patient Protection Act, Federal Patient Protection Act, on the right to sue. Cases circulate along in the lower courts, 2002, 2003. Finally, in 2004, I think it is. Let me check what these cases were. I'll check my notes here for a sec. Well, I don't even have it in my notes. Oh, well. I think it's 2004. I have such incomplete notes. There are two cases that make their way back up to the Supreme Court on just this issue. One of the cases, and both cases are from Texas. One of the cases involves a guy named Davila, D-A-V-I-L-A. And Mr. Davila is suing Aetna again. And his complaint is that he had arthritis, bad arthritis, and his doctor wanted him to use Vioxx. This is before, you know, all of a sudden using it. It turns out probably just as well he didn't use Vioxx, I guess, but, you know, this is when Vioxx was considered the hot thing. His doctor wanted him to use Vioxx, and Aetna said, no, we don't want you to use Vioxx, we want you to use some other drug, some cheaper generic. So he uses the cheaper generic, and he has some huge problems as a result. And he ends up in the emergency room, he ends up very sick, he has all sorts of bleeding, you know, he almost dies, big crisis. So he brings a lawsuit against Aetna claiming he'd been wrongfully denied access to the drugs that he needed, to the prescription drugs that he needed, and he'd suffered injury as a result. He also, using the logic of Pegram, says, because I was wrongfully denied the drugs, I received poor quality care. So I should be able to bring this case in state court and get damages for emotional distress, pain and suffering, and the like. That's one case. Second case involves a woman named Kalad, is her last name, C-A-L-A-D. And Mrs. Kalad is actually suing Cigna, so it's a different insurance company. And she's claiming... Not claiming. I mean, her situation, which is true. I mean, again, admittedly true. There's no dispute over the facts. Her situation is that she'd had a hysterectomy and that her doctor felt she ought to stay in the hospital for a few more days. Cigna said, no, it's time for you to go home. They sent her home, and the next day she was back in the emergency room with all sorts of complications and problems. And she, too, claimed she'd been wrongfully denied care and, as a result, had suffered poor quality care and wanted to bring this case in state court. So everybody's wondering what the Supreme Court is going to do with these two cases. Are they going to allow Mrs. Kalad and Mr. Davila to bring these cases in state court and get whatever verdicts some jury will award them? Or are they limited to bring the cases in federal court under ERISA, in which case all they get is the cost of the Vioxx that was denied, or all they get is the cost of the 2 days of hospitalization that was denied. And so the Supreme Court holds in these cases, with Justice Clarence Thomas writing the decision, the court holds that the original bifurcation holds, that Kalad and Davila have to bring these cases in federal court, and all they're entitled to is the cost of the service that they were denied. That Souter's dicta in the Pegram case is not binding, is not law, is not holding, it's not what they meant, it was misinterpreted, you know, on and on and on and on. Basically, the court comes out and clearly says, it says to Congress, this is how we interpret the law under ERISA. If we're getting it wrong, tell us we're getting it wrong, but this is how we interpret the law. That there's this distinction between poor quality cases and wrongful denial cases, that it is more than a distinction with a difference, and that in the wrongful denial cases, if you belong to an ERISA plan, you have to sue in federal court, and all you get is the cost of the service you were denied. So that decision has become, at least for the time being, the final word on the subject. And that is the law at this point. And what Thomas said in his decision was that if you believe you are being wrongfully denied care, you have a choice. You can either pay for the service, pay for the care yourself, and then sue for the money, which of course isn't necessarily an option if you're low income, working class, or even middle class. Or you could seek what's known as a preliminary injunction. You could go into court and say, I need this surgery tomorrow, and I want the court to order I be given it tomorrow. And if you win in that lawsuit, then you'll get the service right away. But you cannot go without the service and then claim in state court you were wrongfully denied the service. You have to bring that case in federal court, and you're limited in your damages. When that decision came out in 2004, I believe, it had the potential to again dramatically change the politics. And again, part of the reason I'm telling you this story is both so you understand the law in this area, but also so you understand and see the back and forth and the dynamics between the judicial decisions and the politics. The day after the DeVita decision came out, leading Democrats held press conferences to say, we're going to reintroduce tomorrow a federal Patient Protection Act because, look, the court has come out against patients, against consumers. It's come out in favor of the big managed care plans. It's done this terrible thing, on and on and on and on, and therefore we in Congress have to solve this problem with the Patient Protection Act. Except by 2004, the politics of Patient Protection Acts were no longer what they were in 1999 and 2000. By 2004, we were in the midst of a war in Iraq. We'd been in a war in Afghanistan. We had a huge budget deficit. Patient Protection Acts were not high on the political agenda of either President Bush or most Democrats in Congress. And so for the time being, the issue has not risen back to the political agenda, and that is where the law stands today. Now, you'll notice when you get the assignment for the memo, for the next memo that's due on March 20th, you will see that the main thing I'm asking you there is to, you're going to be a legislative assistant to some Ohio congressman, and you have to explain this all to him. And I'm assuming you're all going to be able to explain it pretty well, because between the notes that you took just now and assuming this was podcast work, you're going back and you're sort of maybe sort of going over the lecture again. I'm assuming you're going to be able to get it pretty close to right in terms of what the law now is. But your assignment is going to be, what should Congress do about this and why? You know, and what are the arguments basically for having an expanded right to sue? What are the arguments for having a less expansive right to sue? I mean, those are some of the kinds of things that you're going to think about in the memo that you're going to write. But the politics of it changed, so now Patient Protection Act and right to sue is pretty much off the agenda. Changes the politics, changes the dynamics in terms of... Meanwhile, managed care as an entity has changed dramatically, because managed care as a result of both the market dynamics and the legal dynamics and the judicial dynamics, most managed care plans start allowing more and more and more kinds of care because they don't want the bad publicity from wrongful denials. They don't want litigation. They don't want threats. And so there's fewer and fewer and fewer cases and claims of wrongful denial of care. And managed care begins to change, not so much, in my view anyway, not so much because of what happens in the courts, and not so much because what happened in state legislatures, but it begins to change. Managed care begins to change because of market dynamics and because of changes in what the business community and consumers want. And the markets drive a new kind of managed care, and they lead managed care plans to develop and to create new kinds of tools. And so the new kinds of tools, which we'll talk about on March 20th at our next meeting, are going to be things like provider profiling, are going to be things like disease and case management activities. Those are sort of new kinds of managed care tools which have their pros and cons and ups and downs, and we'll talk about those as long as some issues around publicly managing managed care when we come back in a couple of weeks. Was there a question or two? There was a question or two until people realized that if there wasn't a question or two, class would be over. But I understand that. So why don't we do this? Why don't we stop now, and if you have a question or two, you know, just come down and I'll try to answer it in person.